Standing while the Associate Chief Justice Michael Douglas leads us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
If you please join me. Pledge of Allegiance.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You remain standing for it. Thank you. Please be seated.
And I'd like to thank Justice Douglas for that lively rendition.
Very well done, Michael. This was a surprise to my colleagues. I told them about the Pledge of Allegiance, but I thought the most appropriate song would be Home Means Nevada. And I just want everybody to know we've come a long way since this court met above Fritters in Las Vegas, and then we moved over to the Regional Justice Center, and now this is our home. This is Home Means Nevada here, 4th and Clark, and we're thrilled. And I do want to thank all my colleagues for the support they've given to Justice Hardesty, especially for making this a possibility, a reality. And I'm very proud to be the Chief Justice in this first case. The case is case number 65168, Dante Johnson versus the State of Nevada. Mr. Orland, are you ready to proceed? Did you want to reserve some time?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Sure.
My name is Christopher Warren. I represent the appellant, Dante Johnson. I'd like to start out with a quick quote, since I'm going to be citing to several U.S. Supreme Court cases. And in the dissenting opinion of Oklahoma, the dissenters start out and they say a man's life is at stake. We should not be playing games. And that is in regard to the loss of a peremptory challenge and the use of a peremptory challenge by the defense to try to wrong what the trial court had done in denying a challenge for cause. In this case, there are numerous issues in the guilt part of the case where he was convicted of four counts of first degree murder where there was structural error. First of all, the conclusion of jury selection, counsel said that he wanted counsel argued that a new panel should be brought up because only three minorities were made up of the 80 prospective jurors that were brought up. That is, there was a total after the state used a peremptory challenge to strike a particular African-American woman. That meant that there were only two minorities. One was never questioned. Now, they asked that a new panel be brought in. That was denied. That's the first problem. The second problem is a reoccurring problem. We see with this Batson issue that the female juror was questioned about whether she had any relative that had been incarcerated or arrested. And as we see, she said that her stepson was currently in jail. There was a Batson challenge, and the use or the race-neutral reason was that her arms were crossed and her stepson had been in jail. In State of Nevada v. Cobb, I argued before this court en banc, and I complained that the state was doing this systematically, that they were using the statistics that we know to be true to be able to get an African-American to say they know somebody who has been arrested. And once they question that person, they say, based on their body language, I have to excuse them. During the oral argument, Justice Pickering, you asked me, where are your statistics that 50% of African-Americans, males, are arrested? At the time, I gave a very poor answer. I still remember it today. I said, you Googled it, which I still recall. What a silly answer. In this brief, I have briefed it extensively. 50% of African-Americans, males, will be arrested at some point in their life. Therefore, since we all know that everybody has a father, everybody has two grandparents, grandfathers, that statistically, if I take African-American prospective jurors and say, do you have anybody who's ever been arrested? Did you know, uncle, friend, father? As soon as they say yes, stepson. It's very innocuous. You can read in the record. That juror said, I can be fair. I'll consider all four forms of punishment. What was the race-neutral reason? Her arms were crossed. And I cited Cobb and actually attached the brief. What was the race-neutral reason in Cobb? She wouldn't look directly in the prosecutor's eyes, and she looked at a 90-degree angle. It's the same thing. It's happening over and over and over, and of course, I'm complaining about it, and you see it over and over. Now, we have other significant problems besides Batson and the structural error that comes from Batson and the exclusion of that juror. We have two jurors under Gray that were clearly death qualified. They had strong reservations about the death penalty, but they believe, both jurors said, I could consider it. They're the kind of juror that you imagine the state doesn't want to see on a capital jury.
Yes, you indicated there was one race-neutral reason that the state indicated that she had her arms crossed. But isn't it true that there was more than that they proffered?
They proffered that and the stepson, and they proffered it was body language. But I could see nothing other than that, Justice.
There were some answers to her questions on the questionnaire that they were concerned about. And then specifically, the state had indicated not only did she have her hands crossed and responded with disdain when questioned by the prosecutor. Wouldn't that cause them some pause?
Yes, and what they probably didn't mention is maybe she rolled her eyes. And maybe she giggled when the defense counsel made a joke. And see, these are the same type of things that the record, I can't argue about it because the record would not reflect it. It's very easy to make that type of a record. And so she answered with disdain. But what did she say that was disdainful?
Well, this is all happening before the trial judge. And how much discretion in these cases do you give the trial judge? You know what the standard is.
Yes, and I can answer that with the following. What I would do is I would then carry it on. If we put that away, put that juror away, and then look at how the trial judge handled the rest of voir dire, and then if we come back, then the answer is clear. And what I mean by that is anybody who had any reservations about the death penalty, when the state challenged them, that was Juror Greco and Juror Davis, when they had any reservations about the death penalty, judge granted the challenge for cause. Now, there were three challenges for cause by the defense that the prospective jurors were not life qualified. I have extensively quoted those people, and I'll start with Juror Schenck. That's the Logan's Run individual. Many of you may remember the movie Logan's Run, where criminals are, their numbers put into a barrel, they're drawn out, and then they're fit for execution. This Juror Schenck, told the court that he believed in that and that there was overcrowding in prison and that people should be executed everything above 1 year. And I have a couple of quotes from the state's appendix, very, very briefly, where defense counsel says to Juror Schenck, so you're saying that people who are in prison for anything from car theft to murder, they're eligible for Logan's Run's numbers? Answer, yes. Unless they get less than a year, then they'd be exempt. On the other one, so you're saying that people who are in prison for, but you mentioned earlier, probably the best thing to do is get a random drawing and go into the prisons and run around and pull out the numbers. Yes. So what that juror said and affirmed was that if you are sentenced to anything over a year, you put your number in a barrel, draw it out, and kill you. That person is life qualified? That person is not qualified to sit on any jury, not that criminal jury, at least with somebody facing more than a year. Now, when I look at those, and then I compare it to the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in Gray and in Oklahoma versus Ross, and lastly, in Martinez-Salazar versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court, in all three of those cases, discusses issues very similar to this. However, this case is much more egregious than all of those. In those cases, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering the loss of one peremptory challenge. Here, I can clearly show that three were not life qualified, including Logan's Line. And what in Martinez-Salazar, the U.S. Supreme Court said, and I quote, "In conclusion, we note that this case does not involve a trial court deliberately misapplying the law in order to force the defendant to use a peremptory challenge to correct the court's error." Logan's Line, that is misapplying the law. That man was not qualified. The law was misapplied. And now we have a complete different composition of the jury because the defense is being forced to use 37.5% of their peremptory challenges, which then resulted in one quarter of the jury being completely different. That's just the challenges that were caused by the defense. How about the two that were death qualified? That's five. How about your four? That's an issue. That's six. How about the fact that there wasn't even enough minorities there? And this was a race case. Mr. Johnson has been convicted of executing, killing four individuals, and he is a black man and was accused of killing three white men and a Hispanic. And so this was ultimately important, these issues. This is structural error, and it's just changing the entire composition. I also look at the fact that in both the dissenters in Ross versus Oklahoma were very concerned that only one juror that had been challenged was the challenge was denied and the defense had to use a preemptory. And they said they would overturn it. Those four dissenters on U.S. Supreme Court said they overturn it on one alone. Here, we have six. And so I'm not sure how the state can defend that. And under the circumstances, because there's so much U.S. Supreme Court law on point, I think there is overwhelming evidence that reversal is mandated in this particular case. I recognize that I only have the 5 minutes left, and if there are no questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for
you. Is there a reason you didn't request a 60-minute argument rather than a 30-minute argument?
No, I didn't know it was available. Otherwise, I wish I had.
I counted the issues. There's like over 30 issues that you've raised. Is there any other issue you want to comment on except the jury issues?
I'd really like to. I'll submit it on the other issues. It's been briefed extensively. As you can see, the briefing of the defense is over 200 pages between opening brief and reply. But I really would like to concentrate on jury issues today.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Mr. Rowe, put the state into that.
Will it please the court, I'm Steve Owens with the Clark County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the state of Nevada. Mr. Orem has spent all of his time, in fact, talking about the original jury that convicted Dante Johnson 17 years ago. Some of the claims that pertain to the third penalty hearing, we didn't even touch on those. We're talking about the guilt phase of this trial that was final when this court affirmed all of his convictions and all of his sentences, including four sentences of life without the possibility of parole. Those were all affirmed and were middle issued in 2003. The only thing that was reversed was the death sentences for a redo of the penalty hearing. So my argument as to any claims of ineffective assistance of counsel back in the year 2000 is that those are procedurally barred. They're filed way in excess of the one-year time bar counting from that remitter in the year 2003. When I made this argument in the proceedings below, Mr. Orem said that my interpretation of the procedural bars would lead to an absurd result. I submit that what we're doing here today is absurd. If we are looking at trial counsel's performance for the first time, this court is getting the first chance to look at that, and it was 17 years ago. How can that not be procedurally barred? I have a difficult time reconciling a review of counsel's performance 17 years ago if the procedural bars do not apply. This court has not directly addressed that I've been able to find this issue in a published opinion. There's a couple unpublished orders. I think Mr. Oren pointed to a couple published cases where Jimenez and Mazin, where they had in fact filed just one habeas proceeding after a redo of the penalty hearing. But in both of those claims, it didn't occur to those attorneys to go back and try to file claims from the guilt phase against the trial attorneys. All the claims in those two cases pertains exclusively to the redo of the penalty hearing.
You think there's an exception as to procedural bars when you're dealing with structural error? And if not, I'm sure the answer is no, but why?
Even structural error is procedurally barred. I believe we have authority here in Nevada on that. If not, there's certainly a federal law that says structural error is procedurally barred. It has to be caught in a reasonable amount of time, and it has to be raised in accord with the procedural bars. And it was not here. They let those claims go, and they focused on defending the third penalty hearing. Dante Johnson could have at any time filed a petition, even as just a placeholder, whether it's resolved immediately or it's stayed until after the review of the penalty hearing. But he could have filed that at any time. His attorneys could have filed it. I know Mr. Storm says there was a conflict of interest there, but our habeas statutes contemplate that the defendant files it, and then we could get a new attorney for the new penalty hearing or appoint counsel to do the habeas. But if this court finds merit in any of these attorneys' performances 17 years ago, means we lost 17 years of time, and it was or not that we redid that penalty hearing, because it's going to have to be done again if you reverse the murder conviction. So a lot of wasted time and effort here going back and reviewing counsel's performance.
Are there any issues that you think are still viable from the denial of this post-conviction relief? Any issues? It seems like he's raised about 30 of them.
Viable. Certainly, I have not applied the procedural bars to any claims of ineffective assistance of counsel pertaining to the third penalty hearing. I think those are timely raised. I don't think they have merit. I think this court should deny them all, but I'm not arguing that those are procedurally barred. We're just going back to original trial counsel's performance and on that direct appeal, and everything was pretty much affirmed other than the death sentences. So I'd ask this court to take a hard look at that. If I think everyone's on notice from the plain reading of the statute, as I was when I saw Mr. Oren first raised in his petition here, raised ineffective assistance of third post-conviction counsel, and only in a subsequent brief did it occur to him that, oh, I need to go back and allege trial counsel's performance. So I think people are on notice. I don't think other attorneys have tried to do what Mr. Oren has tried here today to do. But if the court is at all concerned about some sort of ex post facto interpretation and fairness to litigants, make the rule that it applies prospectively so that in the future we don't have this situation. If you were to reverse a death sentence, put them on notice that there are claims against trial counsel that were affirmed on direct appeal, those counsel were affirmed, then those are right. The claim is reasonably available. There's nothing in the habeas rules that says a petition is somehow premature and it can't be filed. Instead, procedures talk about untimeliness, when it cannot be raised, when you have waited too long to raise it.
So, Mr. Owens, one of the criticisms of that approach is that the court would be involved in piecemeal litigation. We would be conducting post-conviction review of trial disputes while there are pending new hearings on the death penalty. I recognize the argument you make about the period of time that exists here, and that is very troubling. But it's equally troubling to have a piecemeal review of these cases while the penalty phase is ongoing in the trial court. What say you about that? How can that be rectified?
I think we're already reviewing them piecemeal. I think this case was bifurcated when this court chose to affirm his convictions and sentences and reverse only as the death penalty. And that forever split the case thereafter. We're always coming back and reviewing issues piecemeal. When they come back from federal court, they'll pick up another part of the case and they'll litigate that for a while. And then they'll go back to federal court, and then come back and raise a new little piece of the apple. When this court found that for capital litigants, the ineffective assistance of first post-conviction counsel constitutes good cause for a successive petition, we deviated from the statutes that say we contemplate one habeas petition where you raise all your claims. Well, ineffective assistance of first post-conviction counsel isn't right, and so as of right, they get a second habeas petition to do that. So that's another sign of how we are already reviewing these things piecemeal. And I think in the interest of expediency, that we're far better, if there was an error in trial counsel performance, we're far better to know that before we redo the penalty hearing and let 17 years go by than raising it now, and in which case we've lost a great deal of time. I better touch on the merits of the jury issues that Mr. Orn has raised. Their cross-section claim, all he's got here is a percentage. He claims 3 out of 80 in the veneer were a minority, and he's got to do more than that. He needs to show that there was systematic exclusion by a procedure designed to not obtain a fair cross-section. Simply throwing out a statistic is not enough. Simply throwing out the jury statistics from this other Cobb case in an unpublished order, that only gives us a sampling of 2. That is not enough. They've got to show more than just a disparate instance in 2 jury trials where the a number of minorities doesn't mirror what's in the population. There's no requirement that it mirror. It just overall, the scheme has to not have a disparate impact. On the Batson challenge, juror number 7 sat with her hands crossed. She had disdain for questioning by the prosecutor. She said it was difficult to pass a judgment on the defendant. When asked about holding people accountable, she said that she had no comment. Her stepson was in jail. And on a question that asked her opinion about the death penalty on the jury questionnaire, she left a blank. So there was 6 good reasons that would cause a prosecutor to be a little bit concerned. Certainly, she didn't meet the criteria for excusing her cause. But you can see that there are 6 factors here that would cause a prosecutor to say, well, maybe I ought to exercise a peremptory. Because that's the purpose of peremptories, to strike someone that you suspect may harbor some biases, but which you're unable to prove. If we could prove it, we would have exercised a cause challenge against her.
Mr. Owens, again, I understand your position on that prospective juror, but Mr. Orne also made the comment that, and I wasn't aware of these statistics, it was interesting, about minority veneer members that are maybe more prone to have some family members that have had brushes with the law and all like that. It's probably true, I mean, just based on society and all that, but how do you deal with that? The big issue here on that, if the state asks to strike anybody that has like a cousin or some sort of maybe indirect family member that's had some arrest in the past, wouldn't that in the long run prejudice minority defendants, you know, from getting a real cross-section of a jury?
Well, for one, just put his blinders on and look at that one, ignoring all these other factors. But just focusing for a minute on the stepson in jail, I don't know whether it's true that certain minority groups or certain socioeconomic groups of individuals might have more run-ins with the law. That sounds plausible. But is that due to bias by the prosecutor? Is that my fault that there are inequities there in society? We're supposed to use our jury voir dire a process to try to remedy socioeconomic inequality. We're simply not supposed to discriminate. And these reasons are all race neutral on their face. And unless you can find that there is some purposeful motivation on the part of the prosecutor to take advantage of those socioeconomic factors so that the prosecutor's true motive is purposeful discrimination, then I don't think you have a passing claim. I certainly don't think they've been able to show that here. We've got all these factors, reasons why this juror would cause some problems for a reasonable prosecutor with race-neutral reasons. The court erred in denying cause challenges. Last time I checked the law, that's Roski, Oklahoma, and I think this Nevada Supreme Court in Weber, we said that's the whole purpose of peremptories. If you had to use a peremptory to excuse somebody that you felt was wrongly not removed for a cause challenge, then the purpose of the peremptory is served. That's why we have peremptories. There's no constitutional independent right to peremptories. They serve the means of obtaining a fair and impartial jury. And and that he had to use a peremptory maybe to kick somebody that he disagreed with on the cause charge is no cause of concern, is not a constitutional violation. This court has said it, the U.S. Supreme Court has said it. Well, not everyone agrees, and there are some dissenters in the minority opinions, and that's fine, but that's the law of the land as far as I'm aware, is the use of the peremptory remedies and holds harmless any error in exercising or denying a properly brought cause challenge. So I don't agree that there are all these problems in the jury voir dire. We're going back to an ordinary, extraordinarily not length of time, trying to judge it in hindsight. I believe this was Judge Silver that tried this case, and we're supposed to defer to the judge who sat there in the courtroom 17 years ago and looked at the jurors and judged the credibility of the prosecutor. We should defer to that unless there's something on the face of the record here that jumps out and says, oh, there's something wrong here, that there's some sort of structural error. I just don't see it. This is also the jury that did not return any death verdict. They hung as to the death sentence. So the death sentence here today was not dependent that we're under a habeas petition to review, was not the result of this particular jury. This jury only found guilt. And guilt for all of the counts. They did not determine the death penalty. So none of the death penalty issues in my mind would be affected by those jurors. The problems that Mr. Orrin has with the jurors really focused on their ability to consider punishment, not bias as to guilt, but their ability to focus on the punishment phase, which they never reached. We've got out of time. I'm losing my voice. Unless there's other questions, I think I'll conclude my remarks.
Any further questions? Thank you,
Mr.
Owens.
Thank you for your
time. Chief,
may I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Owens, you'll agree, though, if the trial judge is not properly excusing people who should be excused for cause, and the defense effectively has to use all their peremptories to correct that, then they're being denied their peremptories. Do you agree with that? And is your issue that that the judge was correct here in all the denying the for cause challenges?
Well, there's no constitutional right to peremptories. It's a statutory right. They're not being denied their constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. And I guess some of the dissenting opinions that Mr. Orrin is relying upon is looking at the situation where the judge somehow is personally has it out to one side and is just denying all their cause challenges and making them use their peremptories, and on the other side, letting them use the peremptories and other methods. I guess that situation could arise. That's not the situation here. I don't see that factually going on. So I don't think that there would be any problem that the scenario that dissenters envision simply isn't here in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wells.
Thanks.
Mr. Orrin, you have 4 minutes and 40 seconds, and I think you need to talk about the procedural barring of the trial and what would be viable from the third penalty hearing.
Yes.
In 4 minutes and 40 seconds. Good luck.
If there's time bar on this particular case, it will result in absurd results. First of all, how could Dante Johnson have filed a writ? This court reverses his sentence of death and affirms his murder convictions. If he files a writ, I don't know how many have ever filled out that writ form. It asks questions like, what's your sentence? Well, I don't have a sentence. When was your sentence imposed? I don't have one of those. How much credit do you have for time served? I don't know. And so how do you fill in the writ form? Will the judge just accept a partially filled in writ form? And then think about how absurd it is. Will the judge appoint counsel? If he is sentenced to death, he has a right to appoint a counsel. But since he's not sentenced to death, the district court judge is never going to appoint counsel. He doesn't deserve it. Furthermore, if he's then sentenced to death but filed this writ, you see that there will constantly be a consecutive following writ. And I don't mean successive, I mean consecutive. There will be writs being heard by this court about the guilt phase and whether there was ineffective trial and appellate counsel. And then there will be a second writ, which undoubtedly, when that second writ comes up, because now he's being sentenced to death, the state will say, well, that's successive. Because under Nevada law, it says that a writ is supposed to be brought, bring all the issues in one particular petition. That's 34.820 subsection 4. Well, how do we do that? Won't be able to do that. Then, 34.750 says that they may appoint an attorney versus 34.820 says they shall appoint an attorney because it's capital. The federal courts will have difficulty with it because there is heightened scrutiny in death penalty cases, but there won't be a heightened scrutiny in that first writ because a man hasn't been sentenced to death. The statute doesn't contemplate any of this. A plain reading of the statute would tell the defendant, I can't file a writ until I've been sentenced. That's what it says. But now we'd be crafting some interpreting the statute in such a way that we're just going to essentially take the plain meaning of it and throw it away. Because you don't file a writ until you've been sentenced. It hadn't been sentenced. So it seems pretty obvious what should happen here, that there shouldn't be a following successive writ. Now, I want to come back if there are no questions about
Mr. Orm, is, even though Whitehead is not a versus State is not a death penalty case, should we consider a ruling in that case?
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
Whitehead versus State?
Should you consider that? That one, well, I would ask the court to consider the three that I mentioned, which were, two of which were capital, Jimenez and Mazin, and I believe also Dawson, where the same thing that's happening right in front of you right now, the same procedure, this court never once mentioned the issue that the state is presenting now. Never once. So why should Dante Johnson be punished for following the same things? If you are looking as a post-conviction lawyer or an appellate lawyer at Mazin, Jimenez, and Dawson, you would say, no, a writ comes at the end. It did in all three of those cases, and the Nevada Supreme Court did not say anything about it, nor did the state complain. So I don't know why they would be able to try to change this now. Furthermore, the district court completely rejected this. I guess I didn't really answer the question you asked me, should the court consider that? I think the court should look at these other matters and look at all of the sites that I put in the brief, Ninth Circuit, that said that a writ should come at the end after sentencing. And it makes perfect sense with that. So if there are no more questions about time bar, I really would like to move to these jury questions. The state is saying that I'm relying upon dissenters. No, not in Gray or not. In Gray, they, on one juror who was death qualified, the state said she wasn't death qualified, and the U.S. Supreme Court reversed on that alone. I've got two Gray jurors here. And then the other three, which I do rely upon the dissenting opinion, but the dicta from it really shows that this is the case to demonstrate that the state cannot be permitted, nor can a trial judge be permitted, to just force the defense into using three preemption challenges, because it just changes the composition of the jury. And it was the majority in Martinez-Salazar, Martinez-Salazar, that said, if you deliberately misapply the law and force a preemptory, it's reversal. And that was the majority who said that. With that, Your Honors, I would respectfully request that all of my issues be considered, and I will submit the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owens and Mr. Orm. You've made history today, being the first appellate counsel to argue before the Supreme Court in our new home. And I thank you for your challenging arguments that you presented to my colleagues and me. This case will stand.